Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
It's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you so much for having me. And just taking in the warmth of your place is a wonderful, wonderful gift on this cold November day, and in your presence here and our presence right now. So what a gift. I want to take you back 23 years to the middle of April 1994. And it was a gray, rainy Seattle night. And my partner, Dave Schull, and I had just flown into Seattle to meet with the search committee at University Congregational United Church of Christ. For the past couple of years, we had looked all around the country for a church that might call a same-sex couple to be their pastors. We had a file cabinet overflowing with 100 rejection letters. Nobody was gay or lesbian was getting a call at that time. And if they were, they were all losing their jobs, including in the very liberal United Church of Christ. And we were just about to give up our search when we got this letter from the search committee at University Congregational Church. And I had been to Seattle once before to climb Mount Rainier with my family, and I had a friend who lives here. And he told me, he said, "Peter, if you're ever going to find a church, it's going to be in Seattle." And I said to Eric, "I would never live in Seattle. I would never live out here. I grew up in Massachusetts." And I said, "Who would live out here so far from civilization on this other coast and in this very strange place?" And lo and behold, ended up being there. On that night that we met with the search committee at this restaurant, there was met the people at the table, and there was this young woman at the table who was a member of the youth group, whose name was Elizabeth. And Elizabeth was very upset on that night, and she'd been crying. And she told our group, she said, "I don't know if you have heard, but Kurt Cobain died today. Mm-hmm. Kurt Cobain took his life." I don't remember what I said, but I hope that I was empathic to this young woman that was obviously very, very upset and empathic about this story about this other young man who had taken his life. It was only that night after leaving that I turned and asked somebody, "Who is Kurt Cobain?" For the last 23 years, every Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, when you meet, I've known exactly where I was going to be and what I was going to do. I know every Sunday morning what time I need to get up, and I have the same breakfast every Sunday morning. I know how long it's going to take me to drive to church. I know the meeting I'm going to have, I know the people I'm going to meet, and I know the cup of coffee and where to get it. Mm-hmm. I know where to sit. I know what to wear, my white robe and my stole. I know how to put on my microphone, and I know how to start it. I know how to make people laugh on Sunday mornings, and I know how to make people feel on Sunday mornings. And I look out in the congregation, and I am blessed to say I know most of those people by name, and some of them very intimately in their lives. And what a gift it is this morning to come on this Sunday morning and not know, how long is it going to take me to get to the ferry? And to get off the ferry and not know exactly where I'm going. To come to a place and have so many people that I have never, ever met before. And to come into a room and go, "I don't know how to sit, and I wonder what chants they're going to use, and what in the world should I wear on this morning?" And then to be met at the door by Elizabeth. And, what a gift. What a gift that is. I want to talk to you this morning about not knowing and the gift of not knowing. And some of you may know this little koan, Dizong. Dizong? Esbayan?
Using the Chinese, so that's...
Where are you going? Bayan said, around on pilgrimage. Dizong said, what is the purpose of pilgrimage? Bayan said, I don't know. Dizong said, not knowing is most intimate. It feels really appropriate this morning to come and a real gift to me personally to come and talk to you about not knowing and to come talk to you about that which is most intimate. Norman Fisher wrote a little piece about this koan years ago, and he said that intimacy is a nice word, maybe perhaps a better word to use than enlightenment, because it means a real intimacy, it means a real oneness with experience, which of course is what we're exploring here, sitting on the Zendo and doing Kinhin, in all this experience together, exploring what is this, what is this, what is this experience. It was 16 years ago, and I knew I needed to die to something. I had absolutely no idea what that meant, other than I just knew I needed to do it. I needed to let go of something, and I had no idea how to do it. Have you ever needed to die to something? Have you ever needed to let go of something? Did you know what to do? What did you do? What do you do? I asked my spiritual director. I'd been seeing Genjo Mirinello for the past 7 years. We sat together every month in his little office. I wondered, how in the world did I end up with a Zen Buddhist priest as a spiritual director? I wasn't a Buddhist. I wasn't interested in Zen things or Buddhist things. But Genjo was a really good listener. He knew his Bible better than I knew my Bible. And he was a really helpful person to talk to about what was going on in my life and my work and my relationships. I asked him, Genjo, how do you die to something? He told me many things. He said, well, some people go away on a retreat by themselves. Some people go on a hike. Some people take some time alone. You could take a Zen sesshin. Ah, I knew it. I knew right then that was exactly what I should do. What's a Zen sesshin? I asked him. Well, it's a week-long experience of intense meditation. Perfect. It's exactly what I needed to do. And I knew that. And so I went on my first sesshin. And I came into a strange room with a bunch of people I did not know and found a place on a mat and sat there with my knees right up in the air. I wondered, what are these people doing with their hands all hunched over? Genjo came in the door, dressed in this robe. There were other people in robes, and these things around their necks. There were chants and things I didn't understand, and bells ringing. And I sat there on that very first sit. Wasn't very long into it, and then I felt it. I felt something, and it was in my hands that I had never, ever felt. And I couldn't stop crying. And I thought, how did these people cry without making any noise? And I wept, and I wept, and I wept, saying, what is this? What is this? What is this? And thankfully, when the bell rang, I bolted right up, and I went right out the door, and I didn't bow to anything, ran to the bathroom, and I put my face right into the towel in the bathroom, and I wept and wept and wept and wept. And when I had a little chance to meet with Genjo, I said, what is this? What is this? He told me it was something about a falling apart, an enlightenment, a quick awakening, a Kensho. I had no idea what he was talking about. But I knew something was happening to me, and I knew I felt something that I'd never, ever felt before. What is this? Who is this? What is this? It took me 9 months before I went back again. I sat at home. I liked sitting. There was something about sitting that was good. It took me a lot of bravery to go back 9 months later. It was worse. I thought, I can't cry anymore. I cried even more. I was braver. I went back 3 months later for the next session. It was a little better, but not a lot. But at that session, I also knew something else. I said, I have to join this community. What? I have to give myself to the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha? What does that even mean? But why do I know? I know, I know, I know. I have to do this thing. I don't even know what that means. And so in September of 2004, I did this little ceremony, and I gave myself to the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. And for years after that, I really struggled with how can I be this Protestant Christian pastor up there talking about Jesus and God and all these words and all these things, and then going early, early morning, every morning, and going and sitting with this little Zen community and giving myself again and again to the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. How can I do this? I do not know. I do not know. But something worked for me. Something was fitting for me. Dave left the church 11 and a half years ago. Left to go off on his own, not knowing. Wanted to work in a little community. Wanted to work in a poor community. And he went away. He went away for a number of months. And as I left him off at the airport, I knew what I was going to do. I knew that I would leave him off at the airport, and I would drive away, and I would start crying, and I wouldn't know when I would stop. And that's what happened. And I went to see Genjo again, and I said, I don't understand what's happening. All I know is I can't breathe. All I know is there's something behind my back that I'm really, really afraid of. He said, psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis. And I knew he was exactly right. 20 years ago at Yale Divinity School, seeing a counselor at that time when Dave and I had just met, the counselor had looked at me and she said, someday, Peter, psychoanalysis might be helpful for you. What? What is that? I knew in 3 months I'd be all better. Whatever it was, Dave would get back and I'd be all better and life would be all back to normal. It was 11 years. Twice a week sitting in Dr. Carter's office talking about who is this. Well, most every morning I sat with my little Zen community asking, who is this? And it was something about those two things meeting that truly, I say to you this morning, it saved my life. It saved my life. But it took my life falling apart for my life to fall back together again. You know, in Christianity, we talk a lot about death and resurrection. It's kind of the big pivotal story. And while a lot of people jump to, well, is it really true? I mean, did Jesus really rise from the dead and all of that and really walk around in some kind of body and all that kind of sounds like supernatural kind of weird stuff. I don't think that's at all what resurrection is all about. But I do think a heart of the resurrection is what Jesus says on the cross. And he says two things among the other things he says. And one of them is that experience we all know. My God, why have you forsaken me? And that kind of truth and that kind of something that we all know. Where the heck are you? And for some of us, our lives end there. Where the heck are you? But it's not the last word of Jesus from the cross. The last word from Jesus on the cross, the tradition says, is what? Into your hands I commend my spirit. Into all of this not knowing, all this not knowing, I give my life. The peace I knew was that I needed to leave my relationship with Dave. I felt like the most painful thing that I'd ever done was perhaps the most painful thing I'd ever done was a kind of resurrection that I didn't want. I didn't want this feeling at all. I didn't want this knowing at all. I didn't want this discovery of all of who is this. But I knew that for me to discover who is this, who am I, was going to necessitate a journey and a leaving and a death. And it was something I did not want to do. And so I fought it, and I went back and forth and in and out, and in all of that time caused a lot of harm, for sure, to others, but also to myself, because I couldn't just let go. And then finally, I let go, or a letting go of that relationship and the death of that relationship and putting that down. And it was then 4 years ago. And I had a sabbatical coming up that spring. And I knew exactly what I was going to do on my sabbatical because I like knowing. And I was going to do what good ministers do on their sabbaticals. I was going to write, and I was going to read, and I was going to paint. Just learned about painting. That's what I was going to do. And then I had this weird picture in my mind. It was of a 30-foot-long sailboat sailing in the South Pacific, and me on the boat. This was so not me. It felt like a picture that ended up in somebody else's imagination. Because the thing is, I've never, ever liked boats. I do not like being out on the water. I hate things that are tippy, and particularly I hate wind. I can't stand wind. But this picture kept coming back to me on this boat. And so I asked, the end of a wedding, there was a friend at the wedding, and I asked Eric, I have this picture of this boat and me on this boat, and he said, Peter, you've got to do it. You've got to learn how to sail. And I said, Eric, I don't want to learn how to sail. This makes no sense to me. And he said, the Center for Wooden Boats, they offer sailing classes coming up in a couple weeks. You ought to check it out. And so I went to that first class, and the first class was perfect, just perfect. I sat in this little class full of middle schoolers, and we learned about the parts of the boat. And then we went out in our little boats, and it was a perfect, perfect day to sail. There was absolutely no wind. We didn't go anywhere. We hardly made it off the dock. I said, I can do this. I can do this. This is going to be okay. Second day out sailing. We get out into the middle of the lake. The boat heels up on the side. We rose above the water, looked down on the water, and suddenly somebody on our boat is screaming, are we going to be all right? Are you sure this is going to be all right? And the instructor says, yes, we're going to be just fine. We're going to tip over. I know we're going to tip over. And then I realized I recognized that voice. It was me, out of body, out of myself, not knowing what is going to happen. And I remembered that experience being in the Zendo those years ago when I fell apart on the cushion. Way back 30 years ago when I was in divinity school, we read this little sentence from H. Richard Niebuhr, and he wrote this. He said, there is something that every one of us in our human lives is going to have to wrestle with, and that is the void. That's the not knowing. And it's that from which we have come and to which we are going to return. And I knew that there was something about this sailing, just like there was with Zen, that was going to be my way, that I needed to explore this not knowing. It necessitated at that time me leaving all this, the comfort of the Zendo, the comfort of meditation. I knew I just was done with it. Done with it. I didn't want to be done with it. I didn't want to be done with my friends. I didn't want to be done with this practice. I was done with it. And I knew I needed to learn how to sail. And I needed to learn how to run. And I needed to learn how to take Zen out in a boat, literally. I needed to know how to move it. And I wondered, would I ever, ever come back to this? I met Seneca a couple of years before at the Zendo. She had shown up, this only Japanese person in this very Japanese practice, and she didn't have a clue what to do. Not a clue what to do. She sat across from me and had to follow all the things about when to take out your teacup and when to do the chants and how to use the chopsticks and how to eat. And she didn't know how to do anything. But she had this incredible presence about her. And there was something about her I found very appealing. Who is this? Seneca and I became good friends. We took walks in parks, and all I wanted to do was reach out and hold her hand. We would go to the pub after sitting on Sunday nights at the Zendo, and I would just want to put my arm around her. Who is this? Who is this? What is this? I told Seneca, Seneca, I really like you. She said, I like you too. I said, no, like I really like you. And her eyes got really big. And she said, I thought you were safe. I said, maybe not so safe. I had just invited her. We were going to be leaving in a week to go spend a week with my parents in Hawaii. She said, who am I going with? I thought I knew this guy. She called her friends in panic. What should I do? They told her, stay close to his mother. Nothing, unfortunately, happened on our vacation. But I came back and I told Seneca again, Seneca, I really, really do like you. And she said, I don't know. I don't know. I'm kind of done with men. I've had some bad experiences with men. I don't know. I called her the next night, invited her for dinner again. I said, how long do you have to not know? It's been a journey of discovery. A journey of discovery, including the fact of sometime after that, I just knew. I knew I needed to ask Seneca to marry me. What the heck is that? Why? Why? What is that? What is that? But do you trust in your not knowing? Do you trust in that? Or do you run back to all the the certainties of who, what you know? Who are you? And what is there about the not knowing about who you are that you are invited to explore today? Amidst all the routines in your life that you know and that define you, where is not knowing calling you? On a November day, stormy, windy, rainy, white-capped, I looked down on Lake Union. And there was a little boat out there heeling in the wind, being battered back and forth. And there was this man on the boat with a great smile on his face and so happy as he practiced tacking in and through and around the wind. And then I realized that was me on the boat. Who is this? Who is this? Who are we becoming? Dizong asked Fan, where are you going? Where are you going? Fan said, around on pilgrimage. Dizong said, what is the purpose of pilgrimage? Fayon said, I don't know. Dizong said, not knowing is most intimate.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.